Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and we have our guest today whom we have stalked and pursued. But she's a busy woman making movies. And we're very happy to have her today, Catherine Hardwick. Hello.
Hey. Hi, you guys.
I would say I wish we had the Kermit every time we announce someone's name.
Oh, fun. Okay.
Just because that in my head, that's what I look like when we say someone's name. Just,
okay, cool.
So, and, hello, beautiful friend.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us.
Hi, rainbow friend.
You and I got to meet at the Savannah Film Festival a couple of years ago, shared a plane ride home. And having just seen your film, Miss You Already, which we'll talk about more later on. And then we all got to chat with you and celebrate the night they debuted The Black Gandola, which is a short.
Which is wonderful.
Made for a wonderful operation, enterprise, called Make a Film Foundation.
Yeah.
And J.K. Simmons was on the show, too, and he talked about it. It's worth spending a couple minutes on this, even though it's not connected to what we're supposed to talk about. Make a Film Foundation is just what it sounds like.
Yep.
You all know Make a Wish Foundation and the lovely things they do for young people who are dreadfully ill, many of them dying, and they make some sort of wish come true to meet a celebrity, to go to the circus, whatever it may be. Make a Film Foundation does the same thing for people who love movies, are passionate about movies, no matter what their age, and they get the movie made. And they get the movie made by professionals. Mm-hmm.
And not just professionals. The best of the best of the best come through.
Everyone seems to want to be part of this.
Yeah.
And Catherine directed this sweet movie for a sweet boy who since passed away.
I don't know if we call it sweet.
Well, no.
It was...
It has zombies in it.
It's true.
But it was such a... Tamika Lamison, who's one of the people that makes everything happen, she's fantastic. And she reached out and asked if my dad would sort of host some of the evening.
Yeah.
And it was at the Academy, which is so cool. Mm-hmm. And the young man who you worked with, whose project this was, Anthony, passed.
Yeah,
but they were able to show it to him in his hospital room.
In the hospital,
yeah,
on a laptop with all the nurses there.
Yep.
Yeah.
So sitting there, having never met this young man, but watching him and seeing the interviews with him and seeing him on set and how excited he was, it was thrilling.
He had a scene with Johnny Depp.
Yep.
And apparently they improvised. Am I getting this right?
Yeah. I got to direct this scene. It's so fun.
But that's like, talk about who all you got.
Oh,
yeah. Because it's a pretty wild group.
Because Sam Raimi also directed some of it, and so did Ted Melfi.
Yes.
Did I say it right?
Yes, you did, yes.
Yeah. So I got to do a segment. They said, tomorrow you're going to do this hospital scene, and it's going to be Dr. Kildare, Richard Chamberlain, and Anthony. I'm like, awesome. And then, I got a call later. Okay, David Lynch and Laura Dern want to come in, and so could you write something for them? And they're only going to have 30 minutes on camera. They're going to just do a drive-by, so you need to do that. And you have, an hour to write it. I'm like, okay, awesome. And then they said, and then at 7 o'clock at night, we're shooting the next morning, Johnny Depp wants to be in it. Can you write a scene for him? I'm like, what? I write it, call my cousin who's a nurse. We got to do something in this hospital. And I thought, they're not really all going to show up. I'm sure everybody's going to get too busy. Nope, they all showed up. And, suddenly, of course, they each got their scenes 10 seconds before.
Yeah.
So Johnny, I had to put it on coffee cups, the lines and everything. Because, how could he even memorize it? He saw it 1 minute before. So he went off script at one point, way off script. And Anthony, so he just started improvising, we're going to have to put 19 needles up in your anus and all this stuff. And Anthony just rolled with it. He was just like, cool. And
he held his own.
He held his own.
He really did.
He didn't just roll with it. He did exactly what you want to do in comedy improv. He upped the ante. Mm-hmm. He made it funny. He actually even steered Johnny back onto the script very skillfully. And I was just sitting there going, holy cow. And at the end cut, he goes, did I just do an improv with Johnny Depp? I'm like, hell yes, you did.
Hell yes, you did.
Killed it, dude. So it was like really fun. And then that was one of the things. They said they thought that he might have lived an extra month just because of that improv.
Right?
Because he's telling everybody he's in the hospital. Yeah, hell yeah, I did an improv with Johnny Depp.
No big deal. No big deal. Just improv with Johnny Depp. So but, his family was there at the Academy. Yeah. We all watched it on the big screen there.
The Academy screen, you know, with the gold statues huge. On each side.
It was just mind-blowing. The whole thing was mind-blowing.
And even when he was, even at the end, like when we were calling, we wanted him to do something for this song and some ADR lines. So we'd call him. He's in the hospital bed. And he'd be like, hey, okay, he did the lines. He'd go, I'd like to keep talking, but Trent Reznor's on the other line for me. Because Trent Reznor's doing the score. I'm like, oh, sorry, not good enough. So your last day. He had some pretty good, awesome times,
And as you said at the beginning, you guys made a point of showing it to him. They put that screen up, like they had popcorn,
and all the nurses.
You can
came
watch
in.
All of this if you go to their website, the Make a Film Foundation. You can see a lot of what you all done. And it's just.
And I try to really treat him because he's an actor in the movie too, just like every other actor. Like, let's work on that line. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. Give him like the real experience, you know.
Sure.
So he had a real interesting experience. Yeah. Well, so it
you
was
also
fun.
Though because he was quite weak at that point. I remember this that he was supposed to stand, but he couldn't really. And there, too, you all worked around it.
Right. Well, I had set up the scene. Look, I found these cool chairs. You're going to be sitting here. He goes, well, I don't want to start sitting. He goes, I want to be seen strong and standing, and then I will sit down. Yeah. So it's like, that's how he wanted to be seen. I'm like, okay, dude.
Oh, God bless him.
Whatever you want, man, we're doing it.
Yeah. Boy, oh, boy.
Not bad.
Yeah.
And bravo you. You helped make this incredible thing come together.
That's still pretty damn sad because the kid was 15 years old in film school, about to do a film summer camp, about to direct something. He got the diagnosis. So, wow.
that's about as heavy as it gets.
Yeah.
But you made a dream come true for him.
Yeah.
And that's no small matter.
He's probably directing something cool up there in the clouds. Mm-hmm.
Imagine all the judgment he's sending your way, because that's the choice you made on this project. I could have done better.
Yeah.
I'll come down and tell you what I like.
Now, Catherine, you've had several careers, at least.
Yeah. Yes, I have. I started as an architect,
I know. I was reading up on this.
Got to build a bunch of buildings.
And apparently you were too hip for the room.
A little bit. They're like, dude, you're a little too creative. I used to dress more like you're dressed right now, and I would have birds in my head and all these layers of clothes, and I presented my last final architecture project, and I'm like taking off layers and showing all the way the plants had started out. Brown at the bottom and then green and blue, and I dressed like this, and at the end it ended up birds in the head, and at the end they were like, oh my God, you should not be an architect. They do not encourage that kind of creativity in architecture. I mean, it's got to meet building codes and everything. I'm like, mine would meet the building codes, but it still would be cool, and you could peek through these eye holes.
And this was a Wells Fargo bank
right?
that she was designing, so.
The coolest bank of
fun experience. And there, I had the washing machines like for this apartment complex, in the mouth of the thing. So the eyes, you would see the washing machines going around, tile and all this. And they were like, no, you need to do something more creative, they told me. But I already had this job to build 120 townhouses in South Texas, where I'm from. So I went ahead and built them all, but I did make life cast of the owner's faces if they wanted, and then I would turn them to whatever they wanted to be, a lion, a devil, an angel, and put them white on white on their buildings or make them into a fountain and stuff. So it still was a bit creative, but and kind of subtle.
A bit creative.
Yeah, right? No, I'm totally going to build your house, but then we're going to do this life mask, and if you want to be a monkey, you've got it. That's so cool.
It was really fun, and it's still there, and you can still see the sculptures. Though some people, when they move, they chiseled them off and took them with them.
That's probably better than leaving them. That might be a little bit weird.
Yeah.
You see that lion up there? That was the owner before. It was a nice guy.
Yeah. Exactly. So then, the teachers had put this into my head, like, maybe I should do something more creative. And I mistakenly thought that the film business encouraged creativity. I didn't know about sequels and IP and all that stuff. And so I came out here and went to UCLA Grad School in Animation, which, you know, animation, wow, that's pretty creative. Yeah. I didn't think that it took, like, millions and billions of dollars.
Yes,
I just thought I'm going to do my little stop motion cutouts.
There's the
stop business, motion cutouts.
There's the business reality. Mm-hmm. Then there's the creative reality, and sometimes they intersect, and every now and then, they merge, but more often not.
Yeah.
Especially when you're going into the stratosphere with money. And, which is kind of a shame. So you did stop motion, huh?
I did, like, cool stop motion at UCLA Animation. Puppy Does the Gumbo, this like crazy song. I did all this animation of Puppy goes into outer space and, you know, does this dance and, you know, it was wild and everything. And I won, like, some student film award, and I'm like, wow, this is going to be easy.
Does it exist somewhere?
Yeah, I think I should probably put it on. Yeah, I think.
Yes, you should. Yeah, yes. I would like to see the puppy in space.
It's pretty fun. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So what was the next step then?
So then I got the award. It was like called a Focus Award or something. And at the moment of winning it, I thought, oh, I'm going to get all these job offers. Well, nobody came to the animated film, but I saw they went to the live action film. So I'm like, oh, hint, hint, maybe you should start writing a live action thing. So I wrote a screenplay and co-wrote it with a friend. We got it picked up. It was going to go, you know, we were in offices, going to make the movie. There was a director, and then all of a sudden they changed the head of the studio, Minnie made, and that went out the window. And it's like, okay. But somebody said, wait a minute, you're an architect. Why don't you production design my movie? Because you know how to do sets and everything. I thought, oh, that sounds neat. I'd never even heard the term. UCLA was more like, you know, radical. We weren't thinking in categories so much like that. And so I started production designing films, low budget, skateboard movie, you know, fun, thrashing with Josh Brolin. It was wild. And, you know, all the skateboards were stolen and, you know, and the people were living in the back of the van and hammocks. And I'm like, yeah. I love it. Roger Corman movie. I was on the back of a motorcycle doing the stunts and everything. Did every job, stunts, weapons. I didn't even know barely a gun from a
Roger,
you know,
gets
rifle.
His money worth. Money's worth.
Oh, my God. I did like seven jobs. It was awesome. Super crazy. And, you know, I thought, okay, I love this. You know, I love the film biz. And then I just started sort of like clawing my way up to things that actually paid or paid like more than 5 cents, more than $100 a week. You know.
I always love the copy and credit. That's how they say it now, which means you're not getting paid. You'll get copy credit and meals.
Yeah, okay, but the meals on Roger Corman, like white bread, loaf of white bread, peanut butter. So I was like, whoa.
Delicious.
Yeah, yummy. Yeah, and even on that Roger Corman movie, we were out in Palmdale, and they put us four to a room, a hotel room. I didn't know anything about unions. I'm like suddenly assigned to sleep in the same bed with the script supervisor who I'd never met. I was like, hey, man, awesome. You know?
So that male was, or female?
Oh, it was a female.
Okay.
Oh, they did segregate it by rooms, by genders. But, you know, you're in the same bed with somebody. Like, you've literally never met the person. I was like, what's up?
Yeah, right. How you doing? I like to sleep on that side.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. But, you know, that made a lot of fun things and crazy things happen on that movie. So I kind of, you'll never forget it, you know. Mm.
Of course not.
It's the summer camp. It's the summer camp experiences where if you look back at it, you go, I just spent 7,000 months doing something absolutely insane and I loved it. Like, yes. I'm exhausted and I can't see straight, but I loved it.
And I did love it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Everything happened. The FBI came investigating when somebody stole an Uzi and this and that.
Stole an Uzi.
Yeah, which I didn't know that it was a real Uzi. They told me to watch all the weapons, which I know nothing about weapons, really. And I thought, they said, oh, they're all rubber. Don't worry about it. So I put a blue tarp over it at lunch. I took them away from the real motorcycle gang, which it was a real motorcycle, to save money. Mm-hmm. It was a real gang from the Valley, mm-hmm. which had their real bikes and everything. So I'm like, can I take your guns? And put them in a pile and put rocks around the thing. And I'm sitting out there in the middle of the desert, 115 degrees out in Palmdale in the summer. And a kid comes up, hey, I'm a PA. I'll watch the weapons. You can go eat lunch. And I go and eat my sandwich, come back. The guy was gone. The Uzi was gone. And a small plane was taking off in the distance.
Oh, God.
And the kid had been in a mental hospital the week before, we found out later. So, yeah, that was fun. It was interesting. It was different.
Well, I mean, traditionally, the Corman School, yeah. as they call it,
yeah.
Gives you real-world education in filmmaking.
Yes, and mm-hmm. I loved every minute of it in a way.
Uzis yes. and shared beds and the FBI and mental institutions.
Welcome to Hollywood.
Right?
Yes, yes.
I always say to people, it's so glamorous, right?
It was.
So glamorous.
Yes.
Best peanut butter and jelly you've ever had.
Well, you designed so many movies.
Yeah.
And I wonder, what was your learning curve? Was it just learning by doing? Or did anybody yes. take you under their wing?
I did not figure out the mentor thing. I did not have a mentor. My first movie, I was basically thrown into this Corman world. Mm-hmm. The next one, I just was in a skateboard movie where they had, you have, $5,000 to do the whole movie. I'm like, wow, okay, well, I guess I better get the skateboards for free. So you call up every skateboard company, you get them for free. Then you see that your assistant is selling skateboards and drugs at the back of the truck. And so you'd see the skateboard that was just a prop and the thing, now it's rolling down the street. Oh, well, a kid gave me money for it. We could use it for something else. I'm like, wow, is that how it works? So I did learn, mm-hmm. by trial and error and fire, which was really a fun way to learn, actually, because I did stuff that you just wouldn't normally do. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do now, probably. Mm-hmm. I would be arrested. I literally, went to Venice Beach and knew nothing about it, just moved here from Texas, and I was supposed to put a big graffiti mural for the Daggers, the bad skateboard team, Tony Alva's team. And I went to downtown LA, found some 12-year-old boys, African-American kids that were really good at graffiti, and I took them to Venice Beach into a rival gang territory, V13, started painting over V13. Oh. I didn't even know better. And then they came out, the gang, threatening us, man, we're going to kill you guys. And I was like, oh, wow, maybe we better get out of here, me and the little kids. We decided to leave the next day. I thought, well, how bad could it be? They'll probably spray paint them. No, they took rollers with black paint and painted over our thing and threatened me and everything. I was like, wow, okay, welcome to LA. And a crack, and they dropped me off one day. Okay, this is the set for the Daggers' house. And I didn't know, we didn't have permission to be there. It was a full-on crack house. I knew really nothing about it. I literally got a crackhead there to help me scrape off the melted, meth and crack and stuff on the table. I'm like, wow.
As one does.
Yeah, I was just like, hey, it's all going to be fine. I'm making a movie. People just looked at me like, you are. But I survived. It was fun. I used real razor wire, and I cut myself with real razor wire. And I'm like, they said, you need to go to the hospital, man. Have you had a tetanus shot? Oh, no, I'll stay till the end of the day. I would just do anything. I knew nothing what was going on, but, it was fun.
Obviously, you were a hearty person.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And hearty,
very hearty.
Both.
Yeah.
See, all of this sounds right for Tank Girl, which is one of my favorite movies ever.
Yes.
And growing up, 100% one of those things. First of all, I didn't ever put together. It took years to figure out that Lori Petty was the same one in A League of Their Own and Tank Girl, because it's such polar opposite things.
Yes.
And I remember one day going, "Oh my God, it's Lori Petty."
That's her.
In the same way, though, seeing her on Orange Is the New Black now, trying to explain to younger people, "No, you guys, you have to understand." Tank Girl.
Tank Girl.
Tank Girl yes. was everything. Halloween, my friend Mia Trams and I, she wanted to be Tank Girl. And she wanted me to be Jet, except she had black hair. I had blonde hair. And we tried reverse? To spray black. I'll never forget attempting to spray my hair black, attempting to spray her hair blonde. But Tank Girl was such
that
a huge thing.
So fun, as you can imagine. Look at all the sets I got to. I got to build a tank with a barbecue pit on top, weld it together, a real tank, use a German tank for this to make the evil tanks, make the airplanes. I mean, it was a super fun design job. Everything was fun in that movie. And I said, let's go out in the middle of White Sands, New Mexico, the national park, and build that Victorian house where they live. They let us do it. I mean, we did incredible things. People come out in the park. How did this house get here? Because it looks so
real.
It was real. I thought, was this here back in the day? Because I tried to make it look like it was a dried up lake bed. And there was a lot of interesting stuff, scarcity of water that we tried to build into the design of it. And, you know, but everything was just creative, like the most creative idea I could have, anyone have. We just did it, you know.
And it shows. And that's the thing. I've always loved costume design, production design. And you watch certain movies. Like, I always think it would have been hilarious to work on the film Orgasmo.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because can you imagine being the guy in charge of props calling up and saying, hi, I need 7,000 dildos delivered immediately. We need to attach them to hats, put one on a dog. So I always think that's the kind of art department you want to be in. You watch Tank Girl, and it's like, yes, someone let me do this.
Every
someone
crazy
let
thing
me make all
thought.
Of it.
And I Want to Get You Sucker was like that too.
Sure.
Because that was with Keenan Ivory Wayans. I was a production designer on that. And any whacked out comedic idea I had, or any of the comedians like Chris Rock and there, would show up and they would have great ideas to improv. So I kind of got to do like a comedy improv of the art department.
Wow.
And like, let's do, you know, the fountain with the girl squirting the milk out of her nipples. Great, do it. Let's have the hooker live in a bed that has a giant lip bed with white teeth pillows. Go for it, Catherine. Every insane idea. It was encouraged.
Now, how lucky were you that you had supportive collaborators?
Yes. The director, Keenan Ivory Wayans, was just like, do it. Encouraged me to be insane.
Great.
And then every day these, you know, outrageous comedians would show up and they would have rewritten their part in a little way, like Chris Rock. And he was like, he'd listen to it. Yeah, I like it. So he encouraged that like level of, you know, just overflow creativity.
Because the idea of filmmaking as a collaborative art form fascinates me. There's somebody in charge, and in most cases it's the director.
Mm-hmm.
Some cases it's the producer or
the studio,
associate producer.
Yeah, okay.
Most in ideal situations it's the director.
Right.
And the director has to set the tone.
Yes.
You know, not only on the set, but in pre-production, you know, getting all of this together. And either he or she encourages this kind of input or has
like
their own fixed ideas.
Yeah.
Did you have both kind of experiences?
I've definitely had both kind of experiences. But, you know, Rachel Talalay directed Tank Girl. Keenan directed I'm Gonna Get You Sucker. And they both were, I think they both had, I mean, Keenan definitely had done comedy improv.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and pretty cool that we're in a studio right now, a comedy improv studio, so that, you know, that they took the idea, the ones that were appropriate, and then ran with it. But when you said something about a learning curve, there were some things that I did as a production designer that I would go, in the early stages, I would just go crazy on my own trip, you know, like, I want to make the set like this with all this stuff. And sometimes it wasn't maybe appropriate for the movie. And they would have to kind of like rein me in. Well, the director would be like, wait a minute, Kat. That's going to take the character off in a whole different direction. So I realized, you know, sometimes I would be a little inappropriate sometimes too. But then the director would say, okay, let's rein it in.
Okay. Because part of it is you have to serve the film.
Yeah. Yes.
And
it's not just all like, what's the kookiest thing I can put on the wall?
Yeah.
Or what's the craziest costume I can wear? Maybe that's not right for the character to be that crazy at that exact moment. Maybe she's depressed and wouldn't be rainbow dyeing her hair or something.
The first time I met you was when you came to my class at USC with Three Kings.
Oh, yeah.
And, boy, did you have an experience there. Because if you folks don't know, George Clooney was still working on ER.
And 4 days a week. Famous.
And they wouldn't let him go. I mean, they needed him to be shooting there. So apparently David O. Russell and whoever was producing it with him had to find a location that was no more than 1 hour's plane ride away.
Exactly.
So that he could spend half the week in Burbank at Warner Brothers shooting ER and the other half shooting Three Kings.
Days with us.
In a make-believe Iraqi
village
that had to look dead authentic, absolutely genuine. And I didn't know that story before I saw the film. And wow, you'd swear you were there.
That was my challenge. And the line producer, Greg Goodman, and I got on a plane and we started going, where can we do this? Since I had done Tank Girl at an abandoned copper mine, it went, ding, the light bulb went off. I like abandoned copper mines. They devastate the landscape. In the mm-hmm. part of Iraq we were shooting, looking at, was no plant life. It's a desert, but most of the Arizona desert has beautiful plants, mm-hmm. really gorgeous. So I thought, I've got to go back to a copper mine where they ruin the landscape. There is a mile tailing pond where there's nothing grows. So that, because of Tank Girl, that's why I knew to go there, and that's where we shot it.
Can you imagine? You see David O. Russell. I worked on this movie called Tank Girl. And because of it, I'm going to make you some Iraq.
I can do Iraq in the middle of this. And the other weird thing was, at that time, there were almost no photographs. We could not find any evidence of what really Iraqi villages looked like at that time, because they weren't posted all over the internet. It was very kind of secretive. So there were a lot of Iraqi refugees living in Phoenix, and I would get there. I'd say, could you bring me your scrapbook? And here they'd be standing in, you know, taking family photo, and then I'd be looking, oh, what's that? A little bit of the wall. Oh, what's that texture? So it was very, but then I did all the graffiti, like the anti-Saddam mm-hmm. Hussein graffiti on his murals, and then I asked them, I was going to do that, but I asked these Iraqi refugees to come and do the graffiti themselves.
Mm.
They went crazy. They started throwing rocks and just beating them up and everything. I was like, okay, calm down. You just ruined my too far.
What did I do?
Yeah, you took it too far. And, you know, yes, their hatred for Saddam Hussein was very authentic, but they were literally destroying the sets. I had to pull them back. It was intense.
Wowee.
Yeah.
You unleash something.
Wowee.
You unleash something.
Intense. And you worked not once, but twice with Rick Linklater.
Yes, who I love. Rick, I learned so many things from him. I was his, you know, production designer on two movies,
mm-hmm.
and it was just a great experience, because Rick is, you know, very unique human being, very inspiring. Starting Austin Film Society, you know, his whole history is amazing. But what he gives to the crew and to people that work with him is amazing too. It was film school once a week at least. We would all watch a movie together that he would project. And he wanted to project them, so he got the prints, he projected them, then he would talk about the movie in depth. You know, so one of the movies I worked on with him was Newton Boys, mm-hmm. which was at this cusp between Westerns and gangster films, mm-hmm. and Westerns and, you know, that automobile. So we watched Westerns, we would watch gangster movies, and he would go into, made at that time period, and he'd go into detail about how they were made and everything. You're just sitting like, okay, awesome. Film school.
It's the best film school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where do I sign up?
Yeah, super cool, because he has encyclopedic knowledge,
I think.
Yeah.
Yes,
you know, of every film ever made. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just went to the Austin Film Society's new theater that's built in Austin now, mm-hmm. and they did a 15th-year reunion for 13 at the Austin Film Society, and Rick and I did the panel together, and it was just super fun.
Oh, how nice.
You know.
Which leads us into your, like, what are we at, your 18th profession? I'm trying to keep up.
Yeah.
Director.
Yes.
And director of a movie that was, see, we go a little nuts because people love to use these big words, and if you keep calling things iconic or legendary or whatever, then you sort of take away the value of that. But what you made did change so much. and had such an effect on people and was unique in a way that we'd never seen before. You worked with Nikki Reed.
I wrote it with a 13-year-old starting right off the gate.
Whom you'd known since she was five.
Exactly. Yeah. I know Nikki since she was five. And you know what's kind of fun? I'm doing a roundtable with Nikki and Evan today.
Oh, wow!
Today, about 13, the 15th year reunion. So very timely. Yeah, so that's I'm going to see the bands come back together.
Walk us through the process.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
What inspired you? What about her inspired you to say, there's a movie here?
Well, Nikki, as you can see, because she's in the movie, is very unique and like a very high-key personality, fun, obviously drop-dead beautiful, which was a special story. You could make a story about somebody that would be more like me, more like an oddball or didn't fit in or wouldn't be, but this was her story of being like super beautiful and super mature at age 13, which attracts its own set of problems, you know, like boy magnet, drug magnet, you know, trouble magnet, bad boy magnet, you know, all these kind of things. So I know Nikki since she was 5 years old, cute, fun, little creative kid, you know, awesome. Actually so creative and so radical at five that I would take her out on the boardwalk at Venice. In Venice, we'd be walking along, and without saying anything to her, I would just jokingly, a couple would walk by and go, hey, do you want to buy a kid? And and then she, without even discussing this before, would go, yeah, I do windows. And the couple would just be like, what? You know, and then we would just do these hilarious comedy improv, guerrilla theater things, you know, and she would just roll with everything and one up it and be hysterical. So she was always like, I never thought of her as a kid, even at five. She was always so on it. But then, so then I left to go to, you know, do a movie in Vancouver. I came back 6 months later, and the bright, fun, creative kid had a dark cloud over. She looked like a baby J-Lo, but she, you know, like perfect. I'm like, holy shit, what happened? And but she had a dark cloud over her, and she hated her mother, who she had been so close with. She hated her father. She hated her brother. She hated everybody in the world. Somehow I was not in that hate cloud because I wasn't in the family and I wasn't around all the time. So I was still okay, like the aunt or whatever. And I thought, okay, I've got to be, I've got to save the day here. I love this family and repair this. And, you know, but I'm not a trained therapist. I didn't know really what to do or anything. And we couldn't afford her to go to therapy or anything because that's $250 an hour or whatever. And the school had no counselor. So I'm like, okay, maybe I can take her to museums and teach her to draw. I like to draw. Maybe she'll like that. Oh, I'll take her to surf camp, teach her to surf. And she's like, she did all those things and brought all her friends, but she's like, these are the things you want to do, Catherine, not what I want to do. Mm. And now she was waking up at 4:30 every morning to do 2 hours of hair and makeup before she went to middle school, okay? And then I said, well, what do you want to do? And she goes, I want to be an actor. I'm like, oh, no, that's going to be worse. You're going to wake up at 3:30. You're going to be so concerned about your image and everything is going to be worse. But I didn't say that. I like zipped my mouth and I thought, okay, if this is what this kid wants to do, I've got to encourage it. I can't squash it. This is what she wants to do. So I'm going to take her to we're going to read Uta Hagen books and take her to Meisner classes, acting classes. And then I took her to a couple of these and I realized, oops, way too mature. You know, the subject matter that you're is not appropriate for a 13-year-old girl. The 13-year-old girl acting classes weren't appropriate for her. They're a little kiddie. I'm like, dude, we got to write our own stuff. Okay, so let's write a teen comedy that you can be in. And I'll direct it because I'd been trying to write my own projects. I'd written several other scripts that had been optioned but never made. And so let's write our own teen comedy.
How'd that go? Yeah.
Didn't really turn out that funny because I'm like, the comedy's got to at least be grounded. Let's do it on real stuff that you're going through, you and your friends are going through. And as we got more real, one day I remember we were literally driving down the street, down Ocean, Pico, past Vidiot's, by the way, which isn't there anymore. And we were driving past Vidiot's, and I looked at her and I go, let's just write about the real stuff you're going through. Let's just make it real and not try to make it funny. Let's just keep it real. And she's like, yep, done deal. And we just decided to do that. And then we had 6 days between Christmas and New Year's before she had to go back to middle school. I go, well, let's write the screenplay in 6 days. Okay? Cool. And we're like, done. So she came over and stayed at my house. Her mother was happy for her to have a vacation. And we were just writing. But the way we wrote it was we acted out every scene. She played herself, which Evan played the part mm-hmm. in the movie, and then I played every other part. So we would just do scenes. We'd just be running around the house, screaming at each other, yelling. And I'm like, 6 days, Nikki, 6 days. Every time she'd get a phone call, and I'd be like, don't answer the phone. But then it was the boyfriend, and she would be in a very heavy scene with me. Then the boyfriend would call, and she'd jump up and down and laughing and screaming. Then he'd say something, what the hell? And she would change her emotion. She'd start screaming at him. Then she'd start crying, all in like 30 seconds. And then hang up the phone. She'd be devastated. I'm like, Nikki, we don't have time for this. And we've only got 6 days. Then day two, I realized, wait a minute. That's what this is about. These shifting emotions, the volatility of this age, and all these things that are flying in. And this, I realized this phone call is a gift. Take it, put it into the script. When these phone calls are all in the script, you know, you see her getting these calls. You see all this outside influence being taken in, and how does she react to everything? And then I just started, okay, that's what this is about, you know. At the end of 6 days, yes, she went back to sixth grade. Yes, seventh grade. Okay.
Even so, seventh grade.
And it was vibrating, the script that we had. It was alive. It was like electric, you know. And I actually did go back into it and round out the mother, because she saw the mother as a two-dimensional villain.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I gave Holly, you know, I spent more time with her real mom and gave Holly more dimension.
And that's Holly Hunter, one of the greatest actresses we've got.
Yes. Holly came and met, you know, Nikki's mom, Cheryl, and they actually, to get Holly's lesson to learn how to cut hair and dye hair, they did it on me. Okay. So Holly learned by, you know, cutting my hair, and Cheryl was teaching. I'm like sitting there, okay.
It grows back. It grows back. It grows back.
That's giving your all for your art.
Yeah. Yes. Well, actually, even worse than that, when I decided Cheryl, her mom, had to read this screenplay and understand what we were doing and had to embrace it.
Yeah.
Cheryl was also cutting my hair. So I felt,
oh, God,
as I'm reading it out loud, Nikki's lying on the bed, Cheryl's got sharp scissors right next to my neck as I'm reading things about the mom. It was a tense moment.
And that's why you only have one ear.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why you cover it. There's only one ear there. It's from talking to her mother. But what a... Everything about that, though, it's very
emotional. And then who financed it?
Okay, so I had just done the movie Laurel Canyon with Lisa Cholodinko, the director, and I was the production designer on it. And I worked with this incredible producer, Jeff Levy-Hinty, who produced all of her movies, I think. And I really loved him. You know, we got along great. He saw how hard I worked on Lisa's movie. And then I said, look, I'm going to make my own movie. Will you read the script when it's done? Yes. So he read the script and he loved it. And at the same time, I went to a party at David O. Russell's house. And the night, and I had the script in my car. Maybe I can get David to read it, because he and I were buddies after Three Kings. But David was like, you know, too busy to read the script. That's cool. But I met this woman who was a therapist and worked with 13-year-old girls. And I said, dude, I'm just writing this thing. And she goes, oh, well, my husband's a producer. His name is Michael London. Okay, and now he's produced many awesome movies like Sideways and all kinds of great stuff. But she said, oh, well, that sounds very interesting. And so I said, well, I happen to have a copy of the script in the car. Oops. And I was going to give it to David, but I gave it to her. And the next morning at 10 o'clock, Michael called me. He said, I read your script last night, and so did Lynn, my wife, and I really want to help you get this made. And I'm like, wow. And, you know, that's pretty rare. Most producers get 50 opinions before they jump on board. But meanwhile, like the next day, Jeff said, I read it too, and I like it. I'm like, I wonder if these two guys would work together. One's on the East Coast, one's on the West. They have different skill sets. They did. Dropped their egos, worked together, and we got some money from Jeff's investment people mm-hmm. that he'd made movies with before with Lisa. And so we got like $750,000 or something like that. Then we got Holly on. That's another fun story. And then we got, I said, well, now we need $500,000 more because we really crunched the numbers and we really needed 1.5 to make it. Even non-union, low budget, we just... to be able to, you know, pay people something, not me, but everybody else. I got paid $3, but that was good. It was the best $3 I've ever earned, hardest $3 I've ever earned.
I'll bet. And your hair as well.
Yes.
You got paid $3 and lost your hair.
Yes, exactly. But then we went to Working Title, and we said we didn't ask for a lot. Like, yes, we could have made for $3 million, you know, but if we just could have $500,000, and that felt under some discretionary something that they mm-hmm. didn't have to do anything, and they gave us that last $500,000.
Wow. And they're the very sharp British producers who have done exceptionally good movies for several decades now.
Yes, yeah. And I had been their production designer on a black Western called Posse, so I knew mm-hmm. Tim and Eric.
That's Mary Von Peebles.
Yes, yeah. Mary Von Peebles. So they knew that I would bust ass, work my mm-hmm. butt off, do my best to do something good. So, you know, they did that, gave the last $500,000, and we made it for 1.5.
Wow. And how long was your shoot?
We had an equivalent of 18 days. Well, I was really 21, but the girls could only work since they were only 14. They had mm-hmm. just turned 14. They could only work the 8 hours. So, you know, it was equivalent of an 18-day shoot and was intense. And there are a lot of scenes. That's a testament to Evan and Nikki and Holly, everybody in the movie. I mean, Evan's in every scene,
yeah.
Evan Rachel Wood. And she was only 14. And she some days we had 13 scenes in one day where she had to do the entire arc of her character all at the school. So we only had one day at the school.
Because movies aren't shot in sequence, and especially low-budget movies, yeah. you have to plan all that out.
So were you cross-boarding as much as you could?
Oh, yeah, cross-boarding. Okay, the school. You got one day at the school on a Saturday. So every school scene, even the first day at school when she's innocent, mm-hmm. then the part where she has to try to become friends, seduce Nikki. Then when she's popular and a badass. Then when she's really spiraling down. Then when she's all that was in one day. Many of those scenes, she had one take.
Wow.
Okay,
man.
Go. Action, go. And Evan nailed every take. She is an exceptionally, I thought she was an alien. I didn't think she could be human, what she did in that movie. She's kills it in every scene. And we just saw it again, like I said, in Austin with half the crowd had never seen it before and half the crowd had, and a big, beautiful theater. And she's everything Evan, Nikki, everyone did still holds up as potent and vivid yeah. as that moment, you know.
That film is electric.
It is. You know. It's also on TV all the time, so I watch it pretty frequently.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. It's just because it captures you, and it does hold up, because I saw it as a kid.
Yeah.
I saw it when it came out, you know, and I still, it's just as good now.
When you see Holly and Evan and Nikki, like the final scenes, you have to feel something because they put their heart mm-hmm. into it. And those scenes were incredible for me as a first-time director. I mean, there's so many. I mean, we could talk about this forever. Well, maybe we should move on, or I don't know if you guys want to move on. But there are incredible things that happen on that movie.
No, now, all right, I have to ask, it's sort of a cliche question, but it's one that I like because sometimes you get interesting responses. You're a first-time director. You've hung around other directors. You've worked
yes.
with many other directors.
Great directors, yeah.
And really talented ones.
Yeah.
And observed, and I assume you were a sponge.
I was.
You know?
Taking my classes and listening every day.
Right. So did you ask anybody for specific advice about your first movie as a director, and did you get any good advice?
Oh, yes, I did. David O. Russell was very harsh critic in the writing stage, which is very good. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget some of the things that he did. I actually gave him a screenplay, another one before that. He read about half of a page, and he and I were very close friends. I would be at his house all the time after we did 13, he and his family and his son, you know, everybody, his wife, everybody. So he read about half a page and he goes, "I'm not reading another word." I'm like, why? He goes, you've got exposition in there. I go, exposition? There's like 3 words of dialogue in what you read. He goes, yeah, it's expository. Because 2 kids are out at Lake Powell, and they said, do you want to go over to Miller's Cut or something? Like, go wakeboarding at Miller's Cut? He goes, they wouldn't say Miller's Cut. They'd say the cut. Because they've been there before. I'm like, damn, okay, he's right. He was right. But hardcore. So that made me so, like, not paranoid, but vigilant about exposition. So that if you look at 13 with that idea, there is no exposition. It's very lean. It's very radical. Mm-hmm. Like, the way the way you learn things about the characters is not expositional, and I've really become very hyper-conscious about that in everything since that one moment. You know, that was hardcore. And he never read another screenplay of mine after that, because I had that line of exposition in there.
Wow. So all I need sometimes is somebody to turn that key and open a door or a window for you.
Yes, very cool. Okay, Rick, I asked Richard Linklater, you know, advice. And so he said, 3 weeks rehearsal. You've got to have 3 weeks rehearsal. Okay, I've never gotten 3 weeks rehearsal. But I fought like, you know, a rabid tiger to have 1 week of rehearsal. And I've had at least that on every movie. And I had that on 13. And I said, okay, no, that week I'm not doing the tech scout. No, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing the production meeting unless it's after hours. I'm working now on 13. I got 6 hours of rehearsal a day for the 5 days. So I got 30 hours. And that's precious. That's gold, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I had that, I decided to have that at the location, at the house where we shot. So they were like, are you out of your mind? We don't even have the money to rent the house for 1 week. How could we rent it an extra week and have it dressed? And so I said to the location manager, okay, then I'm going to go talk to the owner of the house myself if you can't figure this out. Well, how can that work? I said, I'm going to get them excited about this project, care enough about it that they're going to give me that for that extra week. And I said to the art department, too, whatever it takes, that week was golden, invaluable. I'd never have had the movie if I hadn't done that, gone to the mat for that. And those 6 hours every day, I had them more planned out than, you know, I had a schedule, 30 minutes when I'm what scene I'm doing, 3 minutes for a bathroom break. I had it so bored out. So every second was valuable. And that's how I was able to shoot the movie in such a limited amount of time and have incredible performances.
Now, some people, laymen like me who haven't worked in theater or film, hear the word rehearsal, and you think of, oh, that's running lines, you know, and doing rough blocking. You move here and you move here on this line and look over there. But that's not what really rehearsal can be in a situation like this. Tell us what your idea of rehearsal is.
Well, it was that. We did say the lines and we did do rough blocking, so that is accurate. But then it's also a chance for, I kept it very closed, only myself and the actors, and it was in the real space. And I had gone there in advance and tried to think how I could film it with the DP, actually, though. He wasn't allowed in the rehearsal. That's a whole other story. And that was quite funny. But I knew where the light would look best for the actors, and I would try to make this feng shui the set so that the seats, the couch, and everything would sit right, so that they would sit in the right place naturally. They would feel comfortable, and Holly could feel comfortable sitting there because she wanted to keep an eye on the door, this and that. So I had it sort of planned out. But it's also a chance for actors to say those lines for the first time in a, you know, safe environment and feel like, and then they could say, I don't feel like saying this line. I wouldn't say this. Get that out now. You know, if you have that problem, don't do that when we have, you know, the whole crew there and TikTok, and I only got a few hours. And maybe you don't understand why that line is there. Maybe we need to talk about it. Then you'll embrace it. Or maybe we do need to change it. Great, you know, let's make it work. So some of that, we're really trying to feel our way through things, you know.
Wow.
And then I'm trying to learn. Ooh, that was boring. If I think the scene was boring, I was bored in the rehearsal. It's, you know, I don't want it to sit there and lay an egg. No, I got to add some life to it, too, you know.
So what did you think watching it again? What did you think of it?
Well, I was, you know, in awe over, you know, what the actors did. And I was pretty much in shock how much we were able to accomplish. But I remembered every blood, sweat,
of course you did.
Of course you did.
I remember everything. And I know how we were able to do it because I busted my, you know, it looks very documentary. People think it looks very documentary. Mm-hmm. It looks very much like we just grabbed a camera and went, mm-hmm. followed you around. Not at all. Oh. Every shot I had made 50, we had about 50 scenes in the house. I had a floor plan of the house, 50 of them, a diagram where everybody was going to stand, where the camera was going to stand. And I had really, and I had a shot list for every single scene, and even the ones that look simple.
And the magic of it is that it doesn't show.
Yeah, not at all. No.
For an audience member, I think I speak for both of us here, you're not aware of that in the slightest. No. It seemed very organic.
All I was aware of is how much I love the house. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was such a great house.
Cool, isn't it?
That's, yeah. Oh, yeah. But everything about it, everything about how you shot it, the colors, the way the colors come through, mm-hmm. this blue-purple that's sort of always there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still a really special film.
Well, yeah, I remembered all those details. And you're right. I intentionally didn't want you to feel that because when I was working over it with Nikki and her mom and trying to understand what they were really going through, I was filming with my video camera, and I felt like I was filming a war. So I wanted it to be like war photography. In fact, I looked at movies more like The Killing Fields than I did teen comedies, obviously. Because I was like, wait, she's yelling at her. Okay, what? Now the brother comes. Boom, now they're going to run into the other. Boom, she slams the door. Shit! You know, I had to be chasing them around the house. Wow. And that's how we had to do it. But I planned that out, you know. Yeah.
But just like good costume design, just like all of those things, you're not supposed to see it for the most part.
Exactly.
So it worked.
Yeah.
The fact that the film feels like it's organic, feels like you're moving in a certain way, it's a good thing. It means you've succeeded.
Yeah,
and there's so many. The thing is, Twilight, like I love Lords of Dogtown, but Twilight is another sort of a monster that it was kind of... I mean, I remember reading that you were going to be the director, and I thought, these two films, 13 and Lords of Dogtown, they're so great, but they're... I felt like, you're too cool for this, I think was my initial reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
Was I was really interested to see what you would try to do with it, because you do have a unique eye, and you see things in a different way. So I thought, well, if they want this to be blockbuster, just like all the big movies, I thought, well, this should be interesting then. Because you take someone who is a detail person, who focuses on the smaller stuff, and you give them this beast. And so, yeah, it fascinated me. And then, of course, it's also this global phenomenon. And I don't know how the hell you go from doing these movies that are quite personal things that you love to having the kind of stress of one of the biggest films that was going to come out in a long time. You know, they were treating it like the Harry Potters. That's how people were talking about it, was that it was going to be like that. And you think, you can't do that to someone. You can't walk into anything saying, you know how this thing is really popular? You're going to do that. You go, okay.
Well, it's interesting because I have a little different perception from the time. At the time, you know, I can see how it could seem like that. But the way it seemed to me is the movie had, the book had been in, they wrote a script at Paramount with MTV, and then they wrote many drafts of it and deviated a lot from the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went into turnaround. No, nobody wanted to make the movie. Then the Karen Rosenfeld and everybody, Greg, tried to sell it to every other studio in town. Nobody wanted to make it. Nobody thought it would be Harry Potter at the time. This is back at the time, back in the day. They knew that there were some passionate fans, but it was much smaller. And then the script was way off base. So I was at Sundance. I was on the jury. Super fun. 2007, I believe. And Eric Feig and Patrick Wachsberger said, we're starting this new company, Upstart Company. Summit has always been a distribution company, foreign sales. So now now we're going to actually try to make some of our own content. And we've got like 7 scripts. See if you like any of them. Maybe you can connect because they love 13. So I read them all of them. I didn't like any of them. I was just like, trash. Put them all in the trash can. And then the next day I thought, what was that Twilight one? Wait, let me think about that for 2 seconds. Pull it out of the trash. Maybe there's something here. And I went online. I found it was a book. And then I read the book. And then I had the idea. I thought, wow, this writer really captured this crazy, intoxicating, mad first love feeling in this book. And people are just going, you know, I can see how people are sort of like, you know, seduced by this. I wonder if I could make that come through in a film, that you could feel madly in love like that, like I felt when I was like 12 years old, the first crush and all this stuff, Kiki Wallace, whatever, you know, whoever we all had our crushes on. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to see it. I thought, also, I've seen vampires in, like, London, dark alleys and, you know, Paris and all this, but I've never seen them in woods, you know, and outside in nature. And I love trees, and I love moss. I love the Pacific Northwest. My parents lived in Oregon that time. I really love trees. I love the outdoors. I'm, wow, that's kind of cool to see vampires outside. So I made this, like, lookbook, and I went in to meet the guys at Summit, and I said, first of all, this script, Bella was riding a jet ski by the end, chased by the FBI, and she was, like, a super track star and all this. I'm like, this script, trash. I can't even relate to it. I think we just got to start over, closer to the heart of the book, this and that. Here's my images. This is what I want to do. And they're like, okay, cool. Nobody wanted to make the movie at the time. That's what you can't realize. And in fact, and even when we kind of got into it and started realizing, oh, there's more fans. Oh, she's writing another book. Oh, we went to a book signing in Pasadena. Wow, there's 1,200 people crammed into this thing for a book sign. She said the word Edward, and people started screaming and almost fainting. She said a word. I'm like, wow. So we started realizing, okay, this is going to, but it kind of came together. As we started trying to do the movie, and she published another book, and the fan base spread, and, you know, Stephanie's so good at putting the word out and feeding the fan. So it all started growing. Then I'm like, okay, well, there's a baseball sequence. I got to do vampire baseball, man. I need some more money. You know, give me some money. They're like, Catherine, the most popular female-oriented book series, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, it made $29 million. This will never make more than $29 million. We're already giving you like $30 million or whatever, plus P&A. You can't have any more money. So it wasn't thought to be a phenomenon. I wasn't given a check, but there weren't a million people hanging over me because we didn't think it was a friend. They literally said it probably will make $29 million. Now, even as the buzz started building and, you know, all that, and they did so many super smart things. Summit did, Rob Freeman, Nancy Kirkpatrick, to build up the buzz. And Stephanie did too. And everything.
Stephanie Meyer, who wrote the novel.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Amazing, genius stuff they did to get people excited, you know, bring super fans out, you know, before people thought of this, I guess, came to the set, all this great stuff, you know. Even so, the day before it opened on a Thursday night, they said, we think if it makes in the 30s opening weekend, we're going to be happy if it makes 30 million. It made 69 million opening weekend. Nobody knew it. I was in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Really?
Opening weekend for a female director. You know, it made more than any James Bond had ever made at that time, opening weekend. And then they said, okay, chill out, man. Everybody that wanted to see it saw it opening weekend.
Right.
That's all it's ever going to make. Cut to it made 400 million, you know. So nobody really did see it coming. I mean, we were hoping, but
yes, of
we
course.
Did not know.
You guys, vampire baseball. Yeah. Come on.
At one point they said, when I was like begging for like five more, let me have one more shooting day, Catherine, yes, there's a lot of buzz online, but we think that might be 400 girls in Salt Lake City. I'm like, I don't think
they were still
so.
Skeptical?
Oh, yeah. I said, I don't think that's just 400 girls in Salt Lake City. They seem to be all over the world. So no, it shocked the hell out of everybody, you know.
Wow.
And so now we look back and go, but no, I would have never got the job if they thought it was a blockbuster.
Wow.
You know, nobody else wanted the job. Nobody else wanted to make the movie.
But you delivered exactly what the fans wanted to see.
Yeah.
because I got to make it like an indie movie. Mm. I did not have a zillion corporate people over. Since they didn't have expectations, I got to make it more personal. I got to be handheld. I got to pick actors that were not known. They were not Disney stars.
You've got Nikki Reed in there.
They weren't Disney stars. You know, I got to find unique people to be in the movie that weren't big star. I didn't have that pressure. There's not one cast member that anybody had heard of barely before that movie came out. I mean, barely. If you know, okay, Kristen, when she was 11, was in Panic Room, but that wasn't like she wasn't the star of that movie. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was, you know, kind of awesome. I got to do it like an indie film.
Well, that's good for you. I mean, that's no small achievement.
Yeah.
I mean, not just monetarily. I mean, you know.
No, just in general.
As making an entertaining movie.
See, and this is why the stories are fascinating.
Yeah.
This is what makes the story so fascinating is we're never going to know
how it felt for us.
No,
for
of course
at the
not.
Time.
Of course not.
I literally one day... Should we move on?
No, please.
Okay,
please.
So one day I had the storyboards for the vampire baseball sequence up. You know, I had all these ideas. Yeah, cool, vampire baseball, da 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 da. And then they said, okay, it's about, I think it was about 5 weeks before shooting, they said, we need you to cut. The budget has kind of grown for this reason. We chose Portland, but now it's not as cheap as we thought. Bring more people and blah, blah, blah. You've got to cut $3 million out of the budget in 5 days. No, $4 million in 4 days, or we're going to pull the plug and not make the movie. I'm like, okay.
No one eats.
What?
Peanut butter sandwiches for everybody.
So I'm very good at budgets, too, because I was a production designer for a long time. I'm right
And as a production designer, you've got to be responsible for every
pencil,
little
every
item.
Exactly. Thing.
Yes, every pencil.
Every
piece
man
of paper.
Day of every carpenter works 10 man days to build those three walls. I got to know that stuff, and I got to make it work and still be cool. So I'm right brain, left brain. I can switch back and forth, whatever I got to do. So, okay, give me the budget. Where are the big numbers? Snow. Oh, but everybody knows that's supposed to be a snow scene. Well, maybe they won't notice. I'll put eyes. Okay, Vampire baseball. I look at my storyboards, and I just cut out chunks of it. Okay, cut chunks of the end sequence. And then I'm like, and I put X. I leave the boards up on the wall. The really cool sequences I'd come up with, then I put an X through them. I think they're going to come in, and I'm going to show them what I'm going to cut. They're going to be so sad that they're going to say, no, you do not need to cut that. Nope, that's not what happened. They came in. They saw all these amazing things cut. They're like, great, awesome. I go, really? And they're like, really? So I just pulled them all off the wall. I'm like, okay. And I just did it without all those awesome things. And it still came out good, and people liked it.
Have you thought about just making a vampire baseball film? I'm just putting it out there. Vampire baseball, because I would go.
Maybe.
I'm telling you now, I would go to that movie right now.
Okay, cool.
Now, you were in post-production on Miss Bala? Are you still shooting?
Oh, okay. I'm finished with Miss Bala. Mm-hmm. It's in the can. It's coming out January 25th, and it's a super badass movie. Sony did it. We shot it all in Tijuana. all in Tijuana. I was there for lived there for 5 months. It was super fun. We had an all-Mexican crew and cast, except for, I think, 4 actors from the U.S. came. Mm-hmm. Gina Rodriguez, mm-hmm. Ismael Cruz Cordova, sexiest dude ever. Wait till you guys see him. Anthony Mackie, and like one other actor from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's got a neat, fun little cool part.
So give us the so-called elevator pitch on Miss Bala.
Okay. Miss Bala was inspired by a true story that happened maybe 10 years ago in Mexico, where a beauty queen, Miss Sinaloa, was captured by a cartel, and they fell in kind of sort of like a Patty Hearst. They had her like driving getaway cars and stuff like that. So 1 week she had her picture in the paper for being Miss Sinaloa, and a month later, picture in the paper as a mugshot. Okay, so that's a pretty wild story. A wonderful Mexican writer and director made it into a Spanish language movie that came out and went to Cannes Fortnite, I believe, maybe 7 years ago. Really cool. And then they wanted to remake it. She's very passive, the lead character in that movie. We wanted to remake it more, a little bit more active, badass, and a little bit, you know, bigger budget and, you know, kind of stuff. So Sony had had a very cool Mexican writer rewrote it. I'm from the Mexican border. It's a badass woman. I got the gig, and Gina Rodriguez is amazing in it, and we made it for a tight budget, but it's a pretty badass action movie.
Great.
And she has to escape from this cartel situation to save herself and her friend.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, last, I want to talk about my favorite unsung Catherine Hardwicke movie, and you know which one it is, with Drew Barrymore and Toni Collette.
I Miss You Already.
Miss You Already. I just think that is a, it just moved me and touched me, and I thought they gave wonderful performances as lifelong
it's
friends.
It's Toni Collette and Drew Barrymore.
As lifelong friends,
that's
to go
a dream.
An unexpected piece of drama in their relationship.
Yes.
And guys, you can go out, you can watch it, you can download it, you can stream it, you can find a place that still sells Blu-rays and order it. It's a really good film.
It's a beautiful film. I mean, we shot it all in London. A beautiful writer, Marina Banks, had experienced going through young, vibrant, hip, rock and roll girlfriends of hers getting cancer. Mm. And so she thought, man, what do you do if you're like kick-ass, crazy, fun chick, and suddenly something like this comes into your life, and you got kids and a hot boyfriend or a husband, and how do you make, all that? And I mean, for me, it's a comedy too, because I thought Drew and Toni are damn funny.
They are.
They are.
And they are laughing to the last minutes. You know, I mean, I thought people were going to be pretty much laughing through the movie. People are crying for the last half hour, laughing and crying.
Well, it's funny and it's touching. It's both of those things.
Oh, it's so radical. And, you know, London is a very vibrant place to shoot. Mm-hmm. Super fun. And, you know, I love the architecture there. There's all kinds of crazy cool stuff. We had great actors. Dominic Cooper is awesome and sexy and funny in a role that you've never really seen him in. And then Patty Considine, who's also a wonderful director. He's so good as Drew's husband, and they live on a houseboat on the Thames. And, you know, I wanted to move onto that houseboat. I mean, the whole thing is quite fun. And Jacqueline Bisset, the mom, is just a hoot, you know, and all her kind of leather, and getting to work with Jacqueline Bisset. So the whole thing, I mean, and Toni, well, we worked with many doctors and people that had been through all this to try to really get it right, filmed in real clinics and try to really feel what it was like. So, you know, the whole experience was just intense, intensely funny, moving, working with people that had been
Well, that all comes
things.
Through in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there's this funny part, you know, that I kind of added. It wasn't in the script, but I just wanted them to get out of London. And I had been, like, done my thing. Like, one time I was in England and I wanted to go see where Wuthering Heights was. I've got to go see the moors. I've got to go see Heathcliff. And then my friend drove up there. And, of course, it was just pouring down rain. I'm like, I don't care. I'm hiking the moors. I bought a plastic poncho. We're out there, you know. And so I thought that might be fun for them. So we kind of put that in the movie. And that's one of my favorite parts, too, where they just take a cab and just go. Bucket list, let's go to the moors. And then they just improv on the day that they dance with the cab driver too, which, like, that's kind of one of my favorite things because their hearts are so big and they're so fun, you know. So yeah, I love that movie. Thank you for loving that movie.
Well, thank you for making it.
Miss You Already, check it out.
Yes.
Gee, Catherine, I feel like we should block out another 3 hours.
I know. You have such a long list of things.
That's right. You guys didn't even talk. One of almost everybody's favorite movie, a lot of them, is Lords of Dogtown.
Well, I love that movie. It's a great film.
Let's just go. I mean,
yes.
Heath, one of his most, I think, closest to who he really was performances. Mm. And, you know, he's just fabulous, and everybody's really good in it too. Yeah.
And again, you took your documentary eye to a film that had already been made as a great documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And you dramatized it, and still made it feel real.
And that was so fun because I am crazy about Dogtown Z Boys, but of course it is guys, like they all say, middle-aged guys talking about it. And like, I wanted to see those moments, like, how can I really breathe life into those moments so you can really live it in real time? And then the actors worked with their, all the real guys from the documentary are in my movie.
Yeah.
They all have fun cameos, and they all coached and trained and kicked the butts of their counterparts because Tony Alva did not want to be represented by a wimp. So Victor Razzik, I mean, he was kicking his butt in training, and you know that was so fun to see. You know, the and Tony was on the set every single day as the consultant for every detail. That's one reason why you feel okay. It's really real. Back because he still had the sense memory, and then in many cases, I was watching them do the Del Mar skate scene. Do we still have 2 seconds?
Yes, please.
Okay, I was watching them do it, and Tony was out there talking to Adam Alfaro, who was his kick-ass double. But he couldn't get the moves right because Tony has a style. You know, he has his own fabulous style. And I looked at Tony, and by the time he had been coaching for the 2 months he'd been working on the movie, he'd lost weight, and not that he was ever fat, but he'd lost back down to he was the same body as he was when he was 1975. Wow. And I was just kind of going, wait a minute, he's showing these two young kids how to do it, but he can do it perfectly himself. Tony, you're going to be your own double right now. He goes, what? I go, go put a wig on. You're going to double yourself in this scene. He put all the clothes on, and he literally went in a time machine. Can you imagine?
Wow.
He went back in time machine, doubled himself, did all the same routine.
Yeah.
He's looking down at the same old skateboard and the same Vans and his hair in the shadow. And some of the people had come to be, the people that were really at Del Mar that day were in the stands as extras. And if he fucked up, they really yelled at him.
Oh, my God.
And so he was like, oh, my God, I've literally gone back in a time machine. So there was some very real, real moments.
Wow.
And Stacy did his own moves, too, because nobody else could do Stacy stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was pretty crazy, you know. Yeah, it was cool.
But that's you capture these things. Plus, you know, I love Emily Browning.
Oh my
it's another
gosh,
rock and roll
so
movie.
Sexy.
Like
so sexy and fun and great. Yeah.
It's you capture things in a way that only you can.
Oh, thank you.
And it's true.
It's true.
That's why it's exciting to speak to you. And you've done so many different kinds of things. And that, of course, adds to it is you do have an eye.
Yeah.
You have an eye that sees things in a different way. Because not a lot of people could have cut $4 million out of a budget in 4 days. You know? That Corman school.
Looks like it cut something out of her soul, too, at the
right?
same time.
Oh, dear. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, telling you guys,
painful
vampire
moments.
Baseball movie.
Oh, I know. It could have been my
register
better.
That.
I would.
Register.
Vampire baseball skater movie. You're welcome.
You are welcome. Are you a screenwriter, too?
Today I am.
I'm ready.
Let's go. Let's do it. Can you
Catherine,
imagine?
Thank you so much for coming and giving
us
your
time. Well, that was a lot
time.
Of fun. Yeah.
Are you reachable on the social media?
Oh, yeah. I'm on all the different blah, blah, blahs, whatever. Yeah.
And the Twitter is C_Hardwick.
Hardwick with an E at the end.
Hardwick.
Yes.
Eh.
Yeah.
Ooh, Hardwick. Eh.
Yeah. Just to
that's
be clear.
If we're going to pronounce things properly. You know, like shoppy.
Yeah.
Shop.
Okay. I like that.
You know.
And Jesse, where do people find us?
At Leonard Maltin, at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com to read our new voices, which I'm really excited about, and all of my dad's reviews. And he also has a new book out called Hooked on Hollywood. You can get it.
Do I get a free cup?
Oh, no.
Learn more.
Play your cards right. You might know somebody.
Whoa. Okay. This is a tough room. Okay.
Thank you guys so much for listening.
We'll see you next time.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.